Thank you for listening to the Following Films podcast. Today we're joined by Jessamine Bergman and comedian Greg Fitzsimmons. Jessamine is the founder and CEO of Pinky Promise, a production and financing company founded in 2020. Jessie has raised over $23 million in private equity funds and leads a team of women focused on investing in, developing, and producing high-quality films by creatives from underrepresented backgrounds. She was also just profiled in Insider's 25 Rising Stars in Entertainment this past December. More recently, Jessie wrapped production in Rome for the dark comedy I Don't Understand You, starring Nick Kroll and Andrew Rannells. Jessamine honed her craft as a classically trained actress at the Guthrie Theatre BFA Actor Training Program and Shakespeare's Globe Education Program in London. She can be seen acting opposite Eliza Scanlon and Lewis Pullman in The Starling Girl, a film which she also produced. She grew up in the Great Plains of North Dakota and currently resides in Venice, California. Then after the break, we're joined by Greg Fitzsimmons. He's a wildly successful stand-up comedian, an Emmy Award-winning writer, and host of the FitzDog Radio podcast, and has made more than 50 visits to the Howard Stern Show. I had Greg on the show to discuss his work as a director on stand-up specials and his upcoming special. To learn more about both of our guests, follow them on Instagram. You can follow Jessamine by going to @PinkyPromiseFilms, and Greg, you can follow @GregFitzsimmons. Hope you enjoy the show. Thanks. Of course, of course. Happy to, thank you for taking the time to do this today. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So, okay, the first thing I had to jump into is that Pinky Promise is really relatively a new company. And when I look at the slate of films that you have coming up, it's incredibly impressive, the stuff that you have. How have you done this so quickly?
It's a great question. I would say hire the right people. Hire people that are smarter than you. Hire people that are passionate and hardworking individuals. I mean, it's very much a team effort. There are six of us total at Pinky Promise. We're an all women company, and I think of any achievement that we've had in past 3 years, that's the thing that I'm most proud of is the women that I get to work with every day. So we have hard work and a little bit of luck, probably.
Well, of course, in any element of the film industry, luck is definitely going to play and not an insignificant part of the quotient. So how did Pinky Promise start then? It was the idea, I'm assuming, to get a female led and to tell female stories or to at least have females in, you know, different chairs they normally don't get to sit in.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm one of those crazy kids that knew what they wanted to do since I could talk. I mean, when I was like putting on shows in my parents' basements, and my dad was taking me to the farm supply store to buy tarps and ropes to like build sets and things, and like handing out tickets to my relatives that rope in. And so that was always the North Star for me, was getting to work in film. And when I moved out to LA and after graduating from drama school and saw this kind of the stuff that I was, you know, going out for and seeing getting made, I felt like was not really scratching the itch for me. And then I thought, I'm not the only one who's thinking this. And so in the middle of a pandemic, when I was back home in North Dakota, where I'm from,
It's the natural rags to riches from North Dakota.
It's North Dakota Hollywood pipeline. Yeah, it's that one. That really exactly. I was back home in North Dakota in the middle of a pandemic, and I grew up in a family full of entrepreneurs and business people, hardworking folks back home in North Dakota, and just thought, why not now? There's no opportunity cost. I always had the dream, and have from a family of entrepreneurs that, you know, kind of infused that kind of business aspect. So it's that combination of being a background as an actress and a family full of business people, and ultimately just the high level goal of being that I was really instilled in me from my family of saying, if you're given an opportunity and you have a privilege to go for something, then it's your responsibility to do it for others. And, so really the dream for Pinky Promise is to be this lighthouse for artists that, you know, haven't always had the chance to be seen. And I'm very grateful that message has resonated with people and that we're getting to work with the types of artists that, you know, have always dreamed of doing. And the people seem to get it and seem to like it. Cause you can have, you can, it can be, it's an idea, you know, at home on your laptop, it's one thing, but out in the real world is another.
And then does this scratch that itch that when you're getting out of drama school, you're doing these plays when you're a kid, nobody, generally speaking, unless you're a truly exceptionally special child, thinks of themselves as growing up to be a producer.
Well, it was the producing and acting thing, I think, is what I had as a kid. I wanted to do the acting part. But then I learned quickly that I had too many opinions to just be doing the acting thing. And so, I really was just kind of, I don't think I even knew conceptually like so many people even today, you know, what a producer did, but I knew that how involved I wanted to be in the storytelling process. And so as I got older and realized that that was something that's a job that does exist. It's like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. And I still do the acting thing too. So I'm lucky to get to do both.
So then what are you looking for when you're deciding what stories you're going to tell? What are the things that have attracted you so far? Because again, it's one of those things where I look through the films that you're making right now and they're wildly divergent from one another.
That's not an accident. I think, you know, the way that we finance movies is relatively unique at Pinky Promise. It is that traditional VC back end type financing. And so, that's, you know, strategically when we're building out our slate, we really are looking at as not only as, you know, this like, you know, an oeuvre of films, but also, as, you know, diversifying your investment across really different projects, you know, for our investors to have, you know, have eggs in multiple baskets, more shots on goal. But I would say that the through line really is, you know, we're very much a mission driven different company. And so if you look at all those films, you'll see that's evident there. And also the thing that there is always an element that feels life affirming, about these projects, and they have to have a bit of heart. And then if we're really going to, you know, get into the, you know, talk shop about it too, I would say that, you know, internally at Pinky Promise, we talk about the four P's. Every project that we have has to have that. And one being progress, because we're that mission driven company that needs to be, you know, evident, in the process and on screen. Profit. We want to make profitable movies. We want to be able to do this for as long as we can because we really love it. We want to, have a great return for our investors. And then we want to have prestige because we want these movies to have that, live a big life and, you know, make an impact and, you know, take a hold of the zeitgeist. And then most importantly, partners. You know, when you're making a movie, you know, this, it's, you're in the trenches with these people for years. And, you want to know that you're on the same team, and life's too short. You got to make good things with good people. And so if you look across the board at the projects that we have, they all have those things going for them too.
Oh, I mean, I don't know the heart yet in some of these, but you could feel that it doesn't seem like these are cynical films because none of them feel like they're the obvious cash grab kind of idea, like something like The Last Showgirl or Eleanor the Great. These don't, from the outside looking in, not knowing anything really about these films other than a couple of key elements of them, they don't seem like obvious movies that everyone was kind of like begging to make right now. And it's like, but they're also really exciting and intriguing films at the same time.
Thank you. I'm glad that's apparent. That's certainly what we're looking for. And, you know, I'm not the first person to say this, nor will I be the last, but I think it holds true, which is that, you know, the more specific that things get, you know, the more universal they become. And both of those projects are helmed by incredible female directors who, you know, really went for some hyper specific stories. And the result is something that is like just deeply, deeply human, super empathetic towards its the main characters and its lens. And I'm really, really excited for the world to get to meet those beautiful films.
Well, it's that thing, and you're absolutely right. It's the idea that when you drill down into something, you make it so hyper specific and tell something that is so myopic in its point of view, you end up telling something that's universal in the end. And those are some of my favorite films, are things that are almost process films about a world that I have know nothing about, that I just really love being able to see that stories that I wouldn't know existed otherwise. Right? Yeah.
And that's the beauty of the art form too, right? I mean, I really do feel that with film, it's the closest you can get to really being inside of somebody else's head, of seeing what somebody else is seeing. And so, you know, why not get specific with. It doesn't mean it's not going to be universally beloved. I think some of the most universally beloved films, you know, obviously have that, but it's, sure. it's that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's, so I'm a cis white dude from the suburbs, straight guy. There's a, my point of view has been told a lot. Like I'm used to hearing my story and seeing my story represented on screen quite a bit. The thing that I love is when I see things that seem so foreign to me, and it's like, oh no, it's literally the exact same shit I'm going through on a daily basis. It's just, it's a different job. Yeah. It's a different partner. It's a different outfit. It's these things, but it's all the human struggle is very, very similar in all these different situations.
Totally. And I'm, I think in order to be in this industry, you also have to be, have a healthy amount of delusion. So take it with a grain of salt, but I am a forever optimist. And I think that's why, even though obviously the landscape, the market is changing so much right now that ultimately we're always going to have, you know, these magical theatrical experiences, because it's one of the last places that we can go as a society, or people of all walks of life, you know, will volunteer to pay money to sit in a dark room facing the same direction to have a shared experience and put themselves ultimately in the shoes of somebody else. It's you know, it's the empathy machine. I think exactly. it's going to keep going. It might look different, but I think it will.
I hope so. And I mean, it changes, and what the form of theaters and theatrical distribution looks like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, who knows? I thought it was a given, but it's changed so much in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And is ever changing, but it's gotten so much better. You know, I'm 47. So I remember times when reels would break in the middle of seeing films. That doesn't happen anymore. So theatrical the worst yeah. thing at a multiplex is probably on par, if not better, than things I went to when I was a kid, because sort of that ideal presentation that people talk about that exists in certain theaters in, you know, Los Angeles and New York City and Chicago and a couple other places really didn't exist in between those places.
I mean, that's a great perspective, Christopher. And I think that that's how I hope that people will start to feel things. I mean, obviously we've had about as much change as there's ever been in the industry, probably since we went from, you know, silent films to talkies in the past yeah. 3 years. But you know, that's the uncertainty is really the only, you know, given that we have in this life. And I don't know, I'm excited to see what innovation comes out of it. I mean, the industry is obviously ripe for disruption at this moment. And agreed. I know I think that the next great, you know, entertainment entrepreneur and director and filmmakers are out there right now, you know, cooking up some big idea of how they can, you know, capitalize on how everything is changing and for the better. So I'm certainly interested to see how it's all going to shake out. It's obviously one big question mark right now, but, I'm excited to see how it plays out.
Well, from the purely financial standpoint, I know this has been a difficult year for most studios, you know, and for yeah. theatrical, for people, just for people that are own theaters, it's been a tough year, but yeah. this has been one of the most exciting years in recent memory for the actual films that are coming out. They don't necessarily get the attention that they might deserve, but I think that there's some really exciting, interesting voices that are being that, you know, I don't know if it's just because things are being propped up a little bit that maybe the writer's strike threw things off and there was some post-pandemic stuff that made it happen. And so maybe things are getting pushed out a little bit further than they would have, but I've seen yeah. some of the best films I've seen in the last 10 years and just the last.
You know, what are you loving and what are you watching right now?
I like everything, you know, so I was the kind of guy that when I went down to, I started, my love of film came from loving genre movies. So when I went down to see Night of the Living Dead at the Rep House, Akira Kurosawa's Dreams was playing next door. And so that was something I just saw the poster and I went to see Dreams the same weekend and I was floored. And so in my mind, I've always had this thing and that I equate the, you know, kind of grindhouse and the art house together. Those are the same thing. They scratch that same itch for me looking for unique voices. Yeah. And so something like Love Bleeding this year that like, I mean, come on, if you haven't seen that it's,
yeah.
there's just some really exciting stuff that's coming out. So that are, you know, continually getting my hair knocked back. So yeah.
Yeah. You know what movie I loved this year that I was probably the most fun I've had in a movie theater since I can remember is Godzilla Minus One. I saw it in black and white, and I am like, people are going to think I'm like being paid to talk about Godzilla Minus One. That was the most fun I've had in a theater in so long. People in the audience were, first of all, the film's entirely in Japanese. It's an all-American audience. And we were all screaming. We were like screaming and cheering at the screen. And I was just so blown away with it. And so much, it was, even though this, you know, it felt so huge, obviously, dealing with, you know, otherworldly monsters. It was also so emotionally intimate and complex.
It was small. It's a tiny, intimate human story. And they got the humans right in that movie, which is what all those big spectacle movies fuck up. They don't get the humans right in those movies. Like, you guys, most of the time.
We need to be taking notes and like in dealing with some like real stuff, but in a way that entertaining and human and funny and. Yeah. Like super, you know, just nuanced characters. And then also like, you know, heavy stuff. And then also, I mean, by the end of it, you're like, oh, this is a metaphor for what Americans did to Japan and the nuclear bomb. But like, sure. You're getting your foot in the door by, you know, by having this, you know, this iconic, you know, IP, but really we're having a much more complex conversation about, you know, the after effects of nuclear warfare, which is like, wow, they really achieved a lot.
But if you want to watch it as just a fun popcorn movie, you can have a great time with the spectacle in that movie. Oh. And that's, I love films that are able to balance those two things out because it's really rare. It's exceptionally rare to see something
really
like that.
Hard to do. And it's almost like the ball is kind of in your court as an audience member to everything is laid out there for you, but it's like up to you to decide, you know, how deep you're going to go with your viewing experience. And I'm sure you could watch it every time and take away something different from it. It's like, this time I'm watching it as a, you know, popcorn monster thriller. This time I'm watching it as a World War II buff. You know, this time I'm watching it as somebody who really appreciates, you know, post-war family drama. I mean, it's,
I
clearly want to talk about it more.
No, well, I mean, you think about, that's the wonderful thing that I love about genre films is the fact that a lot of times you do have the ability to project yourself into them. You know, great works of art, be it a painting that's on a wall, a book that you read, a film that you're watching, they have some level of interpretation to them. Where you can, and as you grow as a person, as you change as a person, every time I go back to Breakfast of Champions, it's a different book. You know, I've read that book probably once every 5 years since I was a teenager. So and that book it's static. It's the same, but it is a different book every time I pick it up.
Because you're a different person every time.
Of course. Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, so beautiful.
Yeah. And I love that about art. And that's one of the things that it's why I have a tough time understanding people that don't engage with creativity on some level, because it is something that I get if people don't, but if you're not a creative person per se, but if you don't appreciate creativity, it's hard for me. Like if you don't love music or film or art or something like that, I don't know.
That's really interesting. And it almost makes me wonder because, you know, certainly there are those folks exist and but I almost wonder if there's needs to be some kind of shifted definition of what creativity is for that type of person to realize that it already is existing in their life. I mean, I think that's why I love what I get to do and feel like the luckiest girl in the world, because, you know, everything in life is storytelling. I mean, it's everywhere, whether we're cognizant of it or not. If you're watching a commercial on TV, if you're listening to, you know, a jingle and or something, I mean, if you're buying a product, the marketing, I mean, everyone is constantly engaging with storytelling and then the stories that, you know, we tell ourselves. And so even if it's like, if you're a sports fan and you're identifying with some team, you're bought into the human interest aspect of them taking themselves to the championship. So if there's somebody that was like, I really don't, you know, buy into this thing, I'd say you probably do. You just don't, you might not realize that you are, but everyone. No,
there's something.
Our brains are wired, you know, or humans are wired that way.
Well, so everybody has something that they're engaged in on some level. You know, it's just when people come over and they see that I'm a little bit of a, you know, film nerd, that they ask questions and
what gives it away? The wall of the DVD.
Well, the rest of my house, my wife handles. So it actually looks like an adult lives here, but yeah, in the child's corner over here where I work out of.
No, that my favorite type of people on earth are the people that are not afraid to be unabashedly enthusiastic about something. I mean, I think that's it for me. Like, I don't care what it is that you're, you know, obsessed with, but as long as there's something that you can talk about that you just like have this uncontrollable glee in sharing with somebody, I'm like, okay, that's my type of person, is that type of raw enthusiasm. That's what pulls me in.
It's, and I'm such a sucker for that, that I will absolutely try to engage with things that I have no interest in.
So fun to do. That's the best way to learn about something. The best way to learn about something that you have no interest in learning about is find the person who is obsessed with it and thinks about it all the time. Like that should be your teacher. Cause I'm like, wow, suddenly string theory and physics. I'm like, that's amazing. Like, wow. when you find the right person talking about it.
Every discipline, whatever it happens to be, needs its sort of its PR team. They need people communicating for them.
Yes, totally.
To sell the idea of it.
They need a storyteller delivering the story. That's what they need.
Exactly. So, okay, what is the film on your slate right now that you're most excited about? If everything shuts down today and you only have one left, and I guess it's not fair to pick a favorite child, but is there one that you're just really excited to release into the world to see? This is going to be one that I think is really going to get a reaction from people.
Well, I suppose it's kind of your favorite project is kind of always, the next one in some regard. And so I would say that we just a couple weeks ago wrapped up filming a project called Eleanor the Great, which is a project that we developed. You spoke about it before. We developed that at Pinky Promise and it's been with us for a very long time. And Scarlett Johansson, it's her directorial debut. And I think that, that story is so, so powerful and so poignant and so timely. And also, Scarlett is somebody, obviously a household name, one of the most famous women in the world and, hasn't, been in the director's chair before. And so I think that it's going to be really exciting for audiences who are so familiar with her body of work to get to see, her really at the helm. And she was just such a killer on set. Knew exactly what she wanted, knew exactly how she wanted to get it. And I'm really looking forward to audiences being introduced to her as a director. And I'm very, very proud of that film.
I'm a sucker for actors turned directors. I actually, some of my favorite films are done by former actors. Just a question I didn't have prepared for you, I didn't think about till this moment, but if you had a Mount Rushmore of actor director films, is there one that you would nominate?
Oh my God. I'm just like such a sucker for Greta. And I think that people forget sometimes.
She was an actress. Yeah.
She was an actor first. Yeah. So I'd probably say, to me, like Lady Bird is just evergreen.
One of the best openings of, it has a Harold and Maude opening to me. It's just a, if you watch that and you get to the car scene and if you know what you're in store for the next, 90 minutes, and such a great film, really.
Such an incredible film. So I'd say that. I'm trying to, I need to like get a list of, there's so many sneaky ones too. But it's, yeah. I mean, the thing about, I mean, Scarlett, I mean, she has more on-set experience than like everybody else. On
that movie.
She's just been doing it for so long. And so it's very not your normal, quote unquote, first time director experience. I mean, she's a total pro. I'm glad she's going to get her moment. And that's, June Squibb at 94 leading that film was, the term legend gets thrown around a lot. But I mean, come on, like she was more on top of her lines, her performance than a lot of actors that are, less than half her age. So I just an absolute class act to work with. It's really special.
That's pretty great. I could see that. I've been excited for this one. I'm actually excited for several of your films, the Nick Kroll film that you have coming out. I'm looking forward to that.
Oh my God.
Really exciting.
That's amazing. We got to be in Rome for 4 months shooting that movie.
The movie doesn't even have to be good at that point. If you spend 4 months in Rome.
Writer directors are dear friends. Like we were like, oh wait, this is a job. We're having so much fun. We forgot. And then also it's just, Nick and Andrew are so unbelievably hilarious. Like it's not even fair. I mean, I think when you watch that movie, some films you can tell that they knew that the crew was laughing. Like there are some shots that we know because I've watched it a million times. And like they're such incredible performers and stage performers too. Where I'm like they really were playing to their audience in the room in addition to the audience, beyond the screen. So that's that's near and dear to my heart also.
Nice. That's great. He's the incredible performer. I mean, it's just, it's
two of them together as a duo. I mean, they're great friends, but before that project. So, I mean, they just were just riffing, playing off each other, having so much fun. It's
awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this today. I really appreciate it. Where should we send people to keep track of the projects that you're working on? What's the best place to show people online?
Follow us on Instagram at Pinky Promise Films. And then our website, pinkypromisefilms.com. See what we're up to. Would be great.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Thank you. It was so great to finally meet you.
Great to meet you as well. And congratulations. This is, I'm always excited to meet people that just don't seem completely wrapped in cynicism and still have optimism, because I think it's an important thing to hang on to. So
true. I mean, that's why we go to the theater, right? It's like we come to this place, the magic, you know. So it's like the Nicole Kidman quote. But it holds true.
Anybody going to an AMC has heard that a lot.
But lately. We do. It's a bit, but we do. We do. Yeah. She wasn't wrong. No lies were spoken.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I want to lose myself in it, and I'm looking forward to losing myself in more of these films coming down the pike. So congratulations.
Thank you. Well, I really appreciate the support. Thanks. Be well.
Bye-bye. Take care. Thanks, Jesse. Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. This episode of the Following Films podcast is brought to you by Bookmans. So today, I went into Bookmans and decided to try to find a film by Michael Mann. I went over to the Blu-ray section and saw copies of several films I already own, and then I found it, Black Hat. This is one I haven't seen in quite a while since it came out, and I figured maybe it was time for a reassessment of this much-maligned film. So Black Hat is a cybercrime thriller directed by Michael Mann that delves into the world of cybercrime, hacking, and international intrigue. While it promises to be a gripping exploration of the dangers lurking in the digital age, the execution falls short of expectations. The film follows convicted hacker played by Chris Hemsworth, who's temporarily released from prison to help the American and Chinese authorities track down a criminal network that's responsible for a series of major attacks. As the hunt takes them across the globe, Hemsworth's character must navigate the murky waters of the criminal underworld while grappling with his own demons. One of the film's major shortcomings is its lack of technical accuracy and realism. While it attempts to portray the world of hacking authentically, it often falls into cliches and inaccuracies that ultimately undermine the credibility of the story. So the hacking sequences are exaggerated and unrealistic, relying more on flashy visuals than genuine technical expertise. And this is coming from an absolute layman. I am not somebody who knows anything about hacking, and yet I can see some of the things that just flat out aren't true in this film. And that particular disconnect may disappoint viewers familiar with the subject matter or looking for a more grounded portrayal of cybercrime. So despite these flaws, though, Black Hat does have its moments. Michael Mann's signature style is evident in the film's beautiful, sleek cinematography and the signature action sequences, and the international setting adds depth to the narrative. It highlights the global nature of cyber threats and the challenges of international cooperation. Chris Hemsworth delivers a solid performance as Hathaway, bringing the character a sense of depth who's grappling for redemption. And the supporting cast includes, had no idea, I'd completely forgotten this, but Viola Davis, who's really great in the film and adds a lot to the film. But ultimately, Black Hat falls short of its potential. While it offers a glimpse into the world of cybercrime and espionage, its lack of technical accuracy and reliance on cliches detracts from the overall experience. And despite its flaws, fans of Michael Mann's work or of the cyber thriller genre, I guess if you're a huge Johnny Mnemonic fan and you're looking for some more cyber thriller you could do worse than Black Hat. However, for those seeking a more realistic, nuanced exploration of hacking and cybersecurity, this might leave you wanting more, and I'm not sure I can recommend this one. But despite that, this gave me the chance to check out a film that I've been meaning to reevaluate, because I keep hearing that Black Hat is an underrated film, and maybe I'll give it another 10 years, follow back up with this one, and see if it does end up coming around for me. But remember, Bookmans, they have your cool covered. Hope you enjoy the rest of the show. Thanks.
Oh, here we go. I can hear you. I can see you.
There we go.
Beautiful.
How you doing, man?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this today, man. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Well, I've been wanting to talk to you for a little while now, and especially after I saw Road Dogg, because I loved you in that movie. I know it's not a huge part or anything, but I thought you were fucking phenomenal in that thing. I think it was just a really cool little movie, and I thought you managed to lend a level of authenticity to that role that a lot of people would have just played into the hack side of it and not allowed it to be a human. I thought you did a great job with it, man.
Oh, that's very nice to hear. Thank you. I wish more people saw it, but you know, what's cool is you put a movie like that out and you just never know when it's going to kind of pop or get some traction. And I did this movie called Division 3 with Andy Dick a lot of years ago. Yeah. And nobody saw it when it came out. And now it's like this minor little cult movie that a lot of college kids watch.
These things find a life of their own. And a lot of times it seems like it can take a while, but good things do find a way sometimes.
Yes.
So,
yes.
But I was wondering, just how do you see yourself? Because you've had all these different careers in your life. You've been a writer, you've been a producer, you've been author, you're a stand-up comedian. Now you're directing stuff. So you're an actor. How do you see yourself first? Is it stand-up first or?
Yeah, absolutely. Stand-up is the girl that brought me to the dance and I'll stay with her. I'll bring her home from the dance. But I think I have ADHD, and I think I really am always just going towards whatever seems the most exciting at the time. And I'm easily distracted. So I've always gone from writing to stand up to podcasting and, you know, being a talking head on TV shows. I did that for 15 years between Best Week Ever and Chelsea Lately and then Lights Out with David Spade. I feel like I've been commenting on the news for 15 years. And, you know, that kind of quick attention span stuff is really a turn on for me, you know? So I'm game for anything. I get bored of doing the same thing too much. I like moving around.
So then how do you handle the work-life balance with being on the road and then having, you know, the wife and kids and that? Cause that's the one thing that, you know, I'm 47, married, I have two kids, one of them's 13. And I think about the idea when I go away for a week for work, it drives me crazy because I call home and my wife is just in the middle of the shit and I feel like such an asshole for being gone, but I'm also kind of glad I'm not there at the same time, but I still feel like a deadbeat. So.
Yeah. You feel guilty. And the key is never let her know you're having a good time on the road. Just so it was boring. This guy's an asshole. And, no, it's tough, you know, but I also feel like I had to be true to myself. Like I'm a road dog, you know, I go on the road and I feel like my kids pretty much understood it. I think there's probably some residual resentment or whatever, but I think for the most part, I tried to be a present dad when I was home. And with my wife, couldn't be going better. We got our 25th anniversary coming up this summer. And
well, when's your anniversary? Mine's 15 is coming up this in July, so.
July 31st.
Oh, we're the 18th, man. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so I still feel like we're dating. I still am excited to see her. She's the greatest. And so I don't know. I think maybe a little space isn't the worst thing in the world sometimes too.
Well, it's she's the person I want to be with more than anybody else. That's the person that I'm always excited.
My wife?
Yes, of course.
Get in line, pal.
So it's the when that goes away, I think that you know, it goes through, it ebbs and flows, and you have these moments where it's just, you know, it's more difficult than it is others, but it's been easier and easier every year. Though I can't imagine my life without her at this point, and I'm just always amazed when people throw in the towel after 20 years. I feel I'm just kind of surprised by it, that it falls apart. You know, first 5 years, I get that. But when you have all this under and somebody's just used to your bullshit, it seems hard to let go of that. There's so much, I don't know, work that's been done into it. I guess it's tough for me to let go of that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. Obviously, you want to get lucky and get somebody who grows with you. Yeah. Who I think the key to marriage is both people realizing the shortcomings of the other one and not harping on them, and just accepting that there may be something about them you wish was different, but it's just not. And you accept them in the condition they're in. You know, obviously you want them to be challenging themselves, but you also got to realize, like, you know, they're not going to want to like play extreme sports with me, which I would have loved. They're not going to sit and watch football with me, which I would love. There's, you know, with me, obviously she's got I can't even think of things I want to change that much about her, but I guess I'm thinking more about what she's accepted about me, which is, you know, the depression and the ADD. I mean, God bless her. She's just found a way to, you know, still be supportive, but also not take any of it personally.
Well, we all come with our own baggage, and anybody that it's the, you know, if you don't know who the asshole is in the room, it's probably you.
Right.
Kind of thing. If you don't recognize your faults and the bullshit that you're bringing to the table, then I think that's a shortcoming. I mean, my wife puts up with this garbage. So, you know,
are those CDs?
Movies. I'm a movie nerd. So yeah.
Are they DVDs?
Blu-rays and a handful of DVDs still. Most of it I've moved over to Blu-rays and 4Ks at this point.
What's the greatest Martin Scorsese movie?
Oh, depends on the day. I go to King of Comedy a lot. That's probably the one that's the most rewatchable for me.
Yeah.
But there's also, man, what would you say? I mean, Goodfellas is hard to argue with.
I think Goodfellas is one of the greatest movies ever made. I just think, you know, his skill set and his cast of regulars, I just feel like everybody that he uses just pops in that movie. And it's really got an act one, act two, and act three that are so distinct. It's really a perfect script.
It's an incredible story. And
yeah,
there's this idea that somebody was floating that he's going to be doing the new biopic circled back around. He's going to be doing the Frank Sinatra biopic, I guess.
Oh, really?
And somebody pointed out, and it seemed like an oddball choice, but then somebody said, well, if you think about it, it's kind of the continuation of this crime story that he's been telling for a while, where there was kind of the, you know, down and dirty mob guys, which was, you know, Goodfellas. And then there was the expansion out west, which was Casino. And then there was the Irishman, which is sort of the foundational history of these guys and where this came from, the expansion into eventually, you know, trying to become legitimate and going into, you know, the unions and all these things. And then now this would just be the extension into entertainment. And it's all these kind of,
well, and Killers of the Flower Moon was sort of an organized crime. And Oklahoma,
makes a lot of sense. What did you think of that one? I know a lot of people didn't care for it, but
I thought it was a masterpiece. I loved it.
Yeah, same here.
I just thought I loved the way it moved. It just had its own pace, and you had to sort of let yourself get into the rhythm of the movie. And all these people go like, "It's too long. Shut the fuck up." I mean, what's too long? It's like, you know, if it's quality, what, don't you want it to be longer?
I feel the exact same way. If he wants to spend 4.5 hours in that world, please. Yeah. But instead of those same people will bitch about the length of a Scorsese movie and then spend 10 hours on a show that everyone says doesn't get good till season two. So they'll, you know, go into something and invest 10, 15, 20 hours into something that might be good eventually. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's why I'm a sort of a relic. I can feel my age when it comes to that. When I'm four, it's, you know, movies are no longer the center point of the culture anymore. And I miss that a lot.
Although I love my kids are 20 and 23, and I love introducing them to movies. And King of Comedy, I'm pretty sure they haven't seen. That just moved to the top of the queue.
Well, they've seen a version of it. Probably they saw The Joker. So they've seen that sort of retelling of it, and then, you know, put it in context. It's to me, that was one of those movies that kind of came about at the right time. I saw it when I was 16, 17, something like that, I think. And it's just made me realize how much more depth there was to this guy who I'd heard of my whole life. You know, that, you know, De Niro, I thought of as kind of this, he was just always the badass. He was always a tough guy. He was a taxi driver, you know, he had that, but then you see just this deeply broken man and just it's so amazing, amazing story. So I love that one.
Yeah. It's so complicated because, you know, usually the structure of a movie like that is that the guy actually has talent and then you see him blossom and become good. And it's like, no, that is how bad he is, beginning to end. Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, I guess that's, I don't know. Have you seen Baby Reindeer, the thing that's trending on Netflix right now? Really
no,
popular.
How's that?
It's amazing. It's an incredible show. It's an incredible story.
Really?
It's really, really good. I would highly recommend it. It's one of those rare things that ends up at the top of the Netflix charts. It's actually, you can see why it got up there. It's just about a stalker. But it is a utterly compelling story.
All right,
one of those ones. Yeah. Check it out. But it's the bad stand-up comedy in it is one of the things that was so hard to watch in it. Cause you just see this guy, because the guy who wrote it, I guess he was a comedian and he actually puts up his old stand-up in it, like word for word, beat for beat, and just shows how bad it was, which I don't know if I could do that. Do you keep your stuff archived or do you just try to pull it down? The stuff that maybe from, you go back pretty far. So I don't know, they were recording every moment on TikTok when you were in year one and year two.
No, back then they used to just chisel into the cave wall.
Well, we're about the same age. We're in that same neighborhood, but it's,
I've got some very early stuff that's not great. I'm embarrassed to show it to anybody. I really am. Like I feel like I was such a hack. I feel like I was such a fucking, I hated fraternities, but I think I came off as kind of a frat guy, you know, saying chick, fat chicks jokes and stuff. I was like, oh God.
Was that the Boston influence coming out? Just spending college
in New York, but I started in Boston and I think it was definitely affected by that. There was guys like Lenny Clark and Steve Sweeney that were great comics.
Yeah.
But like, you know, some of the material was, you know, if you wrote it down on paper, you'd be like, wait a minute, this is a little misogynistic. And
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
But then
were you in the Boston scene?
No. But I went to college in Delaware. So I had a bunch of friends that ended up going to school in Boston. It's a normal kind of, okay, how far can I get away from my parents? So I went up there quite frequently. I had a good friend who went to Tufts. So I would go up there probably once a month or so.
Okay.
Yeah. Great live music city, great stand-up comedy city. So I really miss going to Boston. It was now I'm in Arizona. So, but it was a great place. Yeah. So then, I'm just curious though, because there's that, you mentioned a word that get into the reason, but something I've been meaning to ask somebody for a long time, because I have an idea of what hack is, but I think I might misconstrue it slightly. Is hack, is that just to you a common premise that people would use? Or is it something that, because hacks can kill. So it's not that it's not necessarily funny. It's just wouldn't be funny to a comedian.
I love some hacks. I love.
Okay.
You know, it's just, it's very broad.
Okay.
It feels like it's not coming from that person. It feels like it's coming from sort of trying to appeal to the base, people's base. And and then the worst version of it is a thief, you know. There's a little, it can spill over from broad to actually, you know, someone who steals jokes.
That makes sense. Then how does that go though? Cause I feel like when I'm, you know, I played music. So when you don't have your own voice right away, you know, when you're picking up a guitar, you have to play in somebody else's style for a long time for probably it's most people never pick up their own voice. So, So is it similar with comedy?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of the comics in New York were Dave Attell for the first 7 years that they did stand up. And I think a lot of the Boston comics were Don Gavin. Some are still Don Gavin. You know, I think, I don't know who the quintessential LA comic would be that affected people, but definitely in the South, every comic out of Texas sounded like Bill Hicks for 20 years. And yeah. So, you know, in the same way that I would think playwrights from the South, you know, Horton Foote probably sounded like Tennessee Williams, and, you know, you absorb what's around you. Obviously, you know, the hair metal bands on the strip were all, you know, I don't know who was the Motley Crue. Who was the first, like, you know, were they the first hair band?
I mean, I guess you could go back to the 70s with hair bands. If it was like New York Dolls, maybe would be the first one. But right, then they were kind of more of a punk rock thing that punk, it got kind of, but I guess that would be the first one. They were the first ones that were really pushing the gender thing like that.
Yeah. But then I think that style of MTV hair bands really started more in the 80s. Yeah.
That was the Sunset Strip, which you said the quintessential LA comedian, even though he was a Texas comedian. Probably Sam Kinison is associated with that Sunset Strip thing.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, sure. I think comics all over the country sounded like Kinison for a while. I think you start out, you block it out, you learn, you get the tools, you get the confidence, and you learn how to play the game. And then what helped me a lot was the alternative comedy scene in New York. There was a place called Luna Lounge.
Sure.
And then coming out to LA, there was Largo and there was M Bar. And so it was a place where you kind of couldn't do the same jokes every week because it was the same crowd. And you were really encouraged to experiment and be personal and talk about your life. And so I took risks there that I would never have taken in the comedy clubs. And I think that helped me develop a different way of going into material than if I'd just been a club comic.
Is it good to have both those muscles, though?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the thing maybe I'm proudest of as a comedian is that I can still work a club like Largo and then go down to Houston and play, Yuck Yucks for the weekend. And so, and I think I'm not changing my act very much in doing those two places. It's essentially the same thing.
That's interesting. So the material just works across the board? Do you have to change the... Timing,
well, I think of myself as maybe the smartest comic at Yuck Yucks and the dumbest one at Long Beach. But somehow it works in both places.
Fair enough. So then with moving into directing a special, with going into that, how do you, I'm just wondering from, how do you take into consideration the look of the special to support the material? Are you thinking about like how you're cutting and the lighting and just the room that you're using for it, just to, when you're doing it for yourself and then when you're kind of supporting somebody else with theirs?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like what I always wish somebody could do for me, which is to be two steps back and look at my act and think about what it's about. And, you know, for me, I think the biggest thing I bring to it is the material. I'm pretty good at like looking at somebody's act. I do this a lot for people and I'll go through their hour and I'll say, lose this, move this to the front, draw that out. There's more there than you're getting out of it. You know, and so, I just love, shaping somebody's act. And I think as far as shooting it, like the one I just did two specials for a guy named Zane Lamprey. And he's a guy, he goes on the road. He's got a travel show where he drinks with people all around the world. And then he very smartly kind of stayed on brand and only does shows in breweries. So he sells out like breweries all around the country. And sometimes it's like, they just get folding chairs and he brings the microphone and the speakers and they just do it. And so that's how we shot the special. We found a brewery down in Huntington Beach on the last one. And it was floor to ceiling. It wasn't even a room they used. It was a storeroom, but it had floor to ceiling kegs stacked on top of each other, 270 degrees. And we just put together a stage and we had one camera guy sitting on top of a stack of kegs shooting the wide shot. And we had, you know, we shot it really dirty. Like we really wanted to see the room. So it was a lot of shooting with, you know, beer equipment in part of the shot and, you know, over through people's heads, through the crowd. And so you really like, if you're, you know, I really wanted people to see that when you go to see, because, you know, specials are kind of an infomercial for your live performances. You want people to see it and go, I want to go see that live.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to give the spirit of a guy who was like, he really comments in the moment about the room and the people. And you know, and I think that there's a lot of different kinds of specials, but for his, it was about showing a guy who gives you a show you wouldn't just see on TV, but that you would want to experience.
Well, that makes perfect sense. That's something that you would want to draw out from somebody. But is that also, and it may, you're supporting the material because he's done this, the drinking show and kind of going out. Do you ever worry about something that might look cool, but take away from the material?
Yeah, I think the main thing is you want to keep one shot from like the belt buckle to the top of the head. And then you want one that's wide of the stage that are pretty locked off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's mostly what you're going to use. And this, you know, the side cameras are great. You know, you got one in the crowd that you mostly are using for edits, you know, to cover an edit. But, you know, no matter what you set up, the you know, the bulk of the special shouldn't be distracting at all. It should just be that should either the wide or that, you know, torso shot. And then, you know, I think when you see like Gerard Carmichael has Spike Lee direct a special, and then you look at it and there's like, yeah, camera's fucking tilted to the side and we're shooting at his shoelaces. And it's like, by the end of it, you go like, what is this? Whose special is this? Spike's or his or Gerard's?
I that's kind of what I was getting at to some, yeah. Where you feel like it is, you know, I watched like Kyle Kinane's last special. It's just Dirt Nap. It's super simple. Hot Cross Buns, Dave Attell's last special. These are really simple specials that are supporting the material. There obviously, yeah, there's moments, if you're paying attention to it, there's a little bit of flourish to it, and they are keeping the momentum going. It's just not a static shot that feels like, right, you know, it was a camera set up in the back of the room and you're never really paying attention to it, which I guess is the idea with anything. You don't, style should be, it should feel natural. It shouldn't draw attention to itself.
Yeah. I've always thought that like whatever camera angle you're looking at, you could imagine that you're sitting in the club and that's your point of view. You know, it shouldn't be, you know, all these specials, Netflix and Comedy Central, they always want a big jib shot. They want the special to start with, you know, you're soaring from the balcony down to the stage and there's, you know, there's footlights that are shooting blue, yeah, and red. And it's like, is that what it's like to watch me live in a club? No, you're selling something that isn't real. So my new special, I directed my own special, and it's just going to start with literally the first words coming out of my mouth is the first frame of the special. Just here
just
I am.
Just right there.
Yeah.
So when did you shoot that?
December at Joe Rogan's club, the Mothership in Austin.
Last time I was in Austin, it was like a week before that place opened. How is it? I've heard nothing but great things about it.
No, it's phenomenal. It's like a rocket ship of a show. It's just everybody's there because they're comedy fans. They're so psyched to be there. The lighting is good. You know, he basically built it, and then Louis C.K. looked at it and he went, "No, man, you want the stage to be higher. You want the." And Joe stopped down for a month and made the changes before he opened up the club. And it's made from the point of view of how a comedian sees a perfect. And there's two rooms. The smaller room is even better than the big room. It's,
oh, really?
Yeah.
So is it like a belly room kind of thing where that's the.
Yeah. Okay. It's like a really big belly room. And and then the other room, I wouldn't even compare the other room to the main room, because the main room is in the Comedy Store can be really tough. It's kind of like. The people in the back, I feel like, aren't always laughing as much, but I think Joe's is a little bit tighter. It's not as, you know, it feels more coherent, I think.
Well, that makes sense, because a comedian put it together. So yeah, you had Louis coming in and consulting on it and having him rebuild the place a month before. Which is, I couldn't imagine the cost of doing something like that, but that just shows the kind of dedication to making it right. How was it to film it there?
It was good. I used a company called 800 Pound Gorilla, and they're sort of like...
Speaking of Kyle Kinane, Yeah.
They do a lot of the big specials, and I paid a little extra to have them fly in their best camera guy. And, you know, I spent a lot of money on it because I thought maybe I'd sell it to a streamer. But in the end, like, I think I might just put it out on YouTube because these streamers, like, they're booked up for the next year. Okay. You know, there's so many specials. And I feel like my whole point of this is to get people to come see me live. And so YouTube is going to be the way that I'm going to get the most eyeballs on it. And so I'm willing to just put it out and not make any money, but have it seen by, you know, I want to try to get to that million viewer mark, you know.
And when would you think about putting it up?
Hopefully late June.
Oh, man, that's great. Congratulations, yeah. Man. That's awesome. Thank you. I feel bad in a sense because it's the that the world is that way that you kind of have just to put it up on YouTube for free. But I'm excited that so many people will get to see it because you're a hell of a comic, man. And that you could get more people into your shows. That's great because you're one of the guys that I always love turning people onto your stuff because you have a bunch of bits. Your story, I'm the Hell Room gig that you have that you told on. I've shared that thing at least 10 times where it's just like, look, this is just a, if you don't get a story like this, then this is why I love stand-up. It's stories like that. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the kind words. It's been 35 years and, you know, I do feel like at this point, the special I put out is going to hold up. It's material that I've been working on since before the pandemic. And so I'm really proud of it and I'm happy to give it away, you know,
that's just awesome.
And move on to the next material at this point. Cause that's the other thing it's about a special is it forces you to create a new hour and I'm excited. I've already got probably a half an hour. So by the time the special comes out, hopefully I'll be close to being able to do 45 minutes of new stuff.
And I know we're right at time right now. And I just one last thing, if it's okay to ask you, just that you're touching on that, the idea of turning over an hour as quickly as some comedians are doing it now, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing to constantly be churning it? Or is it better to have it out working it for several years and really just dialing it in?
I mean, people have funny years and people have tough years. You know, I've had years where I haven't written very much. And so
fair enough.
Put yourself on that clock. I don't know. I see a lot of people put out pretty thin specials when they do it every year. I mean, Louis C.K., I like all of his specials. I don't think he ever like ran dry, but you can't compare yourself to Louis C.K. It's different for everybody. Some people are constantly writing and doing new stuff. You know, Pete Holmes has a new special that's really good. Yeah. I think he's really prolific. Attell has barely put out any specials. And when they come out, it's like an epic moment, you know, his last special was so amazing. And so I think it's different for everybody, but once a year, that's tough for anybody. Carlin did it. And by the end, like they weren't great. I don't think it helped his legacy that he tried to stick to that. Richard Jenny used to do one every year and those were always great. I mean, it really depends.
Man, Richard Jenny was a great one. He was one of the first comedians that I really just that period of those HBO, those were specials at that point.
Yeah.
And he was one of those guys that when he had something out, my God, he's one that's not, I don't know in the general public how well he's remembered, but he was just such a great, incredible comedian.
So, yes. He was one of the best ever.
I agree. Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, man. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
It was really nice to meet you.
Man.
Yeah, no, it was, wanted to do this for a long time, man. So thank you.
Okay, cool.
Awesome.
Thanks, man.
Take care. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye. And I don't want to go home. Not this time. You think the story gets old. But I don't mind. After all. So I was quite scared. So
time is my friend. So
hangovers.